than a factory that's twice as idle. For a while, it seemed that Moore's Law was yielding little except processors that twiddled their thumbs ever faster and ever more of the time. In the late 1990s, this began to be known as the memory wall. Computer science's best defense against hitting that wall has been an ever more elaborate hierarchy, caches for caches for caches, all the way down. Modern consumer laptops, tablets, and smartphones have on the order of a 6-layer memory hierarchy. And managing memory smartly has never been as important to computer science as it is today. So let's start with the first question that comes to mind about caches, or closets for that matter. What do we do when they get full? Eviction and clairvoyance. Depend upon it, there comes a time when for every addition of knowledge, you forget something that you knew before. It is of the highest importance, therefore, not to have useless facts elbowing out the useful ones. Sherlock Holmes. When a cache fills up, you are obviously going to need to make room if you want to store anything else. And in computer science, this making of room is called cache replacement or cache eviction. As Wilkes wrote, since the cache can only be a fraction of the size of the main memory, words cannot be preserved in it indefinitely, and there must be wired into the system an algorithm by which they are progressively overwritten. These algorithms are known as replacement policies, or eviction policies, or simply as caching algorithms. IBM, as we've seen, played an early role in the development of caching systems in the 1960s. Unsurprisingly, it was also the home of seminal early research on caching algorithms, none perhaps as important as that of Laszlo Lesz Beladi. Beladi was born in 1928 in Hungary, where he studied as a mechanical engineer before fleeing to Germany during the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, with nothing but a satchel containing one change of underwear and my graduation paper. From Germany, he went to France, and in 1961, immigrated to the United States, bringing his wife, an infant son, and $1,000 in my pocket, and that's it. It seems he had acquired a finely tuned sense of what to keep and what to leave behind by the time he found himself at IBM working on cache eviction. Beladi's 1966 paper on caching algorithms would become the most cited piece of computer science research for 15 years. As it explains, the goal of cache management is to minimize the number of times you can't find what you're looking for in the cache and must go to the slower main memory to find it. These are known as page faults or cache misses. The optimal cache eviction policy, essentially by definition, Beladi wrote, is when the cache is full, to evict whichever item we'll need again the longest from now. Of course, knowing exactly when you'll need something again is easier said than done. The hypothetical, all-knowing, prescient algorithm that would look ahead and execute the optimal policy is known today in tribute as Beladi's algorithm. Beladi's algorithm is an instance of what computer scientists call a clairvoyant algorithm, one informed by data from the future. It's not necessarily as crazy as it sounds. There are cases where a system might know what to expect. But in general, clairvoyance is hard to come by, and software engineers joke about encountering implementation difficulties when they try to deploy Beladi's algorithm in practice. So the challenge is to find an algorithm that comes as close to clairvoyance as we can get, for all those times when we're stuck firmly in the present and can only guess at what lies ahead. We could just try random eviction, adding new data to the cache and overwriting old data at random. One of the startling early results in caching theory is that, while far from perfect, this approach is not half bad. As it happens, just having a cache at all makes a system more efficient, regardless of how you maintain it. Items you use often will end up back in the cache soon anyway. Another simple strategy is first in, first out, FIFO, where you evict or overwrite whatever has been sitting in the cache the longest, as in Martha Stewart's question, how long have I had it? A third approach is least recently used, LRU, evicting the item that's gone the longest untouched. Stewart's, when was the last time I wore it or used it? It turns out that not only do these two mantras of Stewart's suggest very different policies, one of her suggestions clearly outperforms the other. Bellaby compared random eviction, FIFO, and variants of LRU in a number of scenarios and found that LRU consistently performed the closest to clairvoyance. The LRU principle is effective because of something computer scientists call temporal locality. If a program has called for a particular piece of information once, it's likely to do so again in the near future. Temporal locality results in part from the way computers solve problems. For example, executing a loop that makes a rapid series of related reads and writes. But it emerges in the way people solve problems too. If you are working on your computer, you might be switching among your email, a web browser, and a word processor. The fact that you accessed one of these recently is a clue you're likely to do so again. And all things being equal, the program that you haven't been using for the longest time is also probably the one that won't be used for some time to come. In fact, this principle is even implicit in the interface that computers show to their users. The windows on your computer screen have what's called a Z order, a simulated depth that determines which programs are overlaid on top of which. The least recently used end up at the bottom. As former creative lead for Firefox, Asa Raskin, puts it, much of your time using a modern browser, computer, is spent in the digital equivalent of shuffling papers. This shuffling is also mirrored exactly in the Windows and Mac OS task switching interfaces. When you press Alt-Tab or Command-Tab, you see your applications listed in order from the most recently to the least recently used. The literature on eviction policies goes about as deep as one can imagine, including algorithms that account for frequency as well as recency of use, algorithms that track the time of the next-to-last access rather than the last one, and so on. But despite an abundance of innovative caching schemes, some of which can beat LRU under the right conditions, LRU itself, and minor tweaks thereof, is the overwhelming favorite of computer scientists, and is used in a wide variety of deployed applications at a variety of scales. LRU teaches us that the next thing we can expect to need is the last one we needed, while the thing we'll need after that is probably the second most recent one. And the last thing we can expect to need is the one we've already gone longest without. Unless we have good reason to think otherwise, it seems that our best guide to the future is a mirror image of the past. The nearest thing to clairvoyance is to assume that history repeats itself backward. Turning the library inside out. Deep within the underground Gardner stacks at the University of California, Berkeley, behind a locked door and a prominent staff-only notice, totally off-limits to patrons, is one of the jewels of the UC library system. Cormac McCarthy, Thomas Pynchon, Elizabeth Bishop and J.D. Salinger, Anais Nin, Susan Sontag, Juno Diaz and Michael Chabon, Annie Prue, Mark Strand and Philip K. Dick, William Carlos Williams, Chuck Palahniuk and Toni Morrison, Dennis Johnson, Juliana Spar, Jory Graham and David Sedaris, Sylvia Plath, David Mamet, David Foster Wallace and Neil Gaiman. It isn't the library's rare book collection. It's its cache. As we have already discussed, libraries are a natural example of a memory hierarchy when used in concert with our own desk space. In fact, libraries in themselves, with their various sections and storage facilities, are a great example of a memory hierarchy with multiple levels. As a consequence, they face all sorts of caching problems. They have to decide which books to put in the limited display space at the front of the library, which to keep in their stacks, and which to consign to off-site storage. The policy for which books to shunt off-site varies from library to library, but almost all use a version of LRU. For the main stacks, for example, says Beth Dupuy, who oversees the process in the UC Berkeley libraries, if an item hasn't been used in 12 years, that's the cutoff. At the other end of the spectrum from the books untouched in a dozen years is the library's rough sorting area, which we visited in the previous chapter. This is where books go just after they're returned, before they're fully sorted and shelved once again in the stacks. The irony is that the hard-working assistants putting them back on their shelves might, in some sense, be making them less ordered. Here's why. If temporal locality holds, then the rough sorting shelves contain the most important books in the whole building. These are the books that were most recently used, so they are the ones that patrons are most likely to be looking for. It seems a crime that arguably the juiciest and most browse-worthy shelf of the library's miles of stacks is both hidden away and constantly eroded by earnest library staff just doing their jobs. Meanwhile, the lobby of the Moffitt Undergraduate Library, the location of the most prominent and accessible shelves, showcases the library's most recently acquired books. This is instantiating a kind of FIFO cache, privileging the items that were last added to the library, not last read. The dominant performance of the LRU algorithm in most tests that computer scientists have thrown at it leads to a simple suggestion. Turn the library inside out. Put acquisitions in the back for those who want to find them, and put the most recently returned items in the lobby, where they are ripe for the browsing. Humans are social creatures, and presumably the undergraduate body would find it interesting to peruse its own reading habits. It would nudge the campus toward a more organic and free-form version of what colleges strive for when they assign common books, the facilitation of intellectual common points of reference. Here, the books being read on campus, whatever they happen to be, would become the books most likely to be serendipitously encountered by other students. A kind of grassroots, bottom-up analog of the Common Book program. But a system like this wouldn't only be more socially positive. Since the items most recently returned are the ones most likely to be next checked out, it would also be more efficient. It's true that students might be puzzled by the fact that popular books will sometimes be found in the stacks and sometimes in the lobby. However, recently returned books that await reshelving are missing from the stacks either way. It's just that currently they are off limits during this brief limbo. Allowing the returned books to adorn the lobby instead would give students a chance to short-circuit the shelving process entirely. No employees would have to venture into the stacks to deposit the volumes, and no students would have to venture into the stacks to get them back out. That's exactly how caching is meant to work. The cloud at the end of the street. We actually made a map of the country on the scale of a mile to the mile. Have you used it much? I inquired. It has never been spread out yet, said Mein Herr. The farmers objected. They said it would cover the whole country and shut out the sunlight. So we now use the country itself as its own map, and I assure you it does nearly as well. Lewis Carroll. We often think of the internet as a flat, independent, and loosely connected network. In fact, it's none of those things. A quarter of all internet traffic at present is handled by a single corporation, one that manages to stay almost entirely out of the headlines. This Massachusetts-based company is called Akamai, and they're in the caching business. We also think of the internet as abstract, dematerial, post-geographic. We're told that our data is in the cloud, which is meant to suggest a diffuse, distant place. Again, none of these are true. The reality is that the internet is all about bundles of physical wires and racks of metal, and it's much more closely tied to geography than you might expect. Engineers think about geography on a tiny scale when they design computer hardware. Faster memory is usually placed closer to the processor, minimizing the length of the wires that information has to travel along. Today's processor cycles are measured in gigahertz, which is to say they are performing operations in fractions of nanoseconds. For reference, that's the time it takes light to travel a few inches. So the physical layout of a computer's internals is very much a concern. And applying the same principle at a dramatically larger scale, actual geography turns out to be critical for the functioning of the web, where the wires span not inches, but potentially thousands of miles. If you can create a cache of web page content that is physically, geographically closer to the people who want it, you can serve those pages faster. Much of the traffic on the internet is now handled by content distribution networks, CDNs, which have computers around the world that maintain copies of popular websites. This allows users requesting those pages to get their data from a computer that's nearby without having to make the long haul across continents to the original server. The largest of these CDNs is managed by Akamai. Content providers pay for their websites to be Akamized for better performance. An Australian who streams video from the BBC, for instance, is probably hitting local Akamai servers in Sydney. The request never makes it to London at all. It doesn't have to. Says Akamai's chief architect, Stephen Luden, "It's our belief, and we build the company around the fact, that distance matters." In our earlier discussion, we noted that certain types of computer memory have faster performance but cost more per unit of storage, leading to a memory hierarchy that tries to get the best of both. But it's not actually necessary to have memory made of different materials for caching to make sense. Caching is just as useful when it's proximity rather than performance that's the scarce resource. This fundamental insight, that in-demand files should be stored near the location where they are used, also translates into purely physical environments. For example, Amazon's enormous fulfillment centers generally eschew any type of human-comprehensible organization, of the kind you'd find in a library or department store. Instead, employees are told to place incoming items wherever they can find space in the warehouse. Batteries cheek by jowl with pencil sharpeners, diapers, barbecue grills, and Learn the Dobro DVDs. And tag the location of each item in a central database using barcodes. But this deliberately disorganized-looking storage system still has one visible exception. High-demand items are placed in a different area, more quickly accessible than the rest. That area is Amazon's cache. Recently, Amazon was granted a patent for an innovation that pushes this principle one step further. The patent talks about anticipatory package shipping, which the press seized upon as though Amazon could somehow mail you something before you bought it. Amazon, like any technology company, would love to have that kind of Bellady-like clairvoyance, but for the next best thing, it turns to caching. Their patent is actually for shipping items that have been recently popular in a given region to a staging warehouse in that region, like having their own CDN for physical goods. Then, when somebody places an order, the item is just down the street. Anticipating the purchases of individuals is challenging, but when predicting the purchases of a few thousand people, the law of large numbers kicks in. Somebody in Berkeley is going to order, say, recycled toilet paper in a given day. And when they do, it's already most of the way there. When the things popular in an area are also from that area, an even more interesting geography of the cloud emerges. In 2011, film critic Micah Mertes created a map of the United States using each state's local favorites from Netflix, highlighting the movies uncommonly popular in each of those states. Overwhelmingly, it turned out, people love watching movies set where they live. Washingtonians favor Singles, set in Seattle. Louisianans watch The Big Easy, set in New Orleans. Angelenos unsurprisingly enjoy LA Story. Alaskans love Braving Alaska, and Montanans, Montana Sky. And because nothing benefits quite so much from local caching as the enormous files that comprise full-length HD video, it's certain that Netflix has arranged it so the files for, say, LA Story live right in Los Angeles, just like its characters, and, more importantly, its fans. Caching on the home front. While caching began as a scheme for organizing digital information inside computers, it's clear that it is just as applicable to organizing physical objects in human environments. When we spoke to John Hennessy, president of Stanford University and a pioneering computer architect who helped develop modern caching systems, he immediately saw the link. Caching is such an obvious thing because we do it all the time. I mean, the amount of information I get, certain things I have to keep track of right now, a bunch of things I have on my desk, and then other things are filed away, and then eventually filed into the university archive system, where it takes a whole day to get stuff out of it if I wanted. But we use that technique all the time to try to organize our lives. The direct parallel between these problems means that there's the potential to consciously apply the solutions from computer science to the home. First, when you're deciding what to keep and what to throw away, LRU is potentially a good principle to use, much better than FIFO. You shouldn't necessarily toss that t-shirt from college if you still wear it every now and then. But the plaid pants you haven't worn in ages, those can be somebody else's thrift store bonanza. Second, exploit geography. Make sure things are in whatever cache is closest to the place where they're typically used. This isn't a concrete recommendation in most home organization books, but it consistently turns up in the schemes that actual people describe as working well for them. I keep running and exercise gear in a crate on the floor of my front coat closet, says one person quoted in Julie Morgenstern's Organizing from the Inside Out, for instance. I like having it close to the front door. A slightly more extreme example appears in the book Keeping Found Things Found by William Jones. A doctor told me about her approach to keeping things. My kids think I'm wacky, but I put things where I think I'll need them again later, even if it doesn't make much sense. As an example of her system, she told me that she keeps extra vacuum cleaner bags behind the couch in the living room. Behind the couch in the living room? Does that make any sense? It turns out that when the vacuum cleaner is used, it is usually used for the carpet in the living room. When a vacuum cleaner bag gets full and a new one is needed, it's usually in the living room, and that's just where the vacuum cleaner bags are. A final insight, which hasn't yet made it into guides on closet organization, is that of the multi-level memory hierarchy. Having a cache is efficient, but having multiple levels of caches, from smallest and fastest to largest and slowest, can be even better. Where your belongings are concerned, your closet is one cache level, your basement another, and a self-storage locker a third. These are in decreasing order of access speed, of course, so you should use the LRU principle as the basis for deciding what gets evicted from each level to the next. But you might also be able to speed things up by adding yet another level of caching, an even smaller, faster, closer one than your closet. Tom's otherwise extremely tolerant wife objects to a pile of clothes next to the bed, despite his insistence that it's in fact a highly efficient caching scheme. Fortunately, our conversations with computer scientists reveal the solution to this problem too. Rick Ballew of UC San Diego, who studies search engines from a cognitive perspective, recommended the use of a valet stand. Though you don't see too many of them these days, a valet stand is essentially a one-outfit closet, a compound hanger for jacket, tie, and slacks, the perfect piece of hardware for your domestic caching needs. Which just goes to show that computer scientists won't only save you time, they might also save your marriage. Filing and piling. After deciding what to keep and where it should go, The final challenge is knowing how to organize it. We've talked about what goes in the closet and where the closet should be, but how should things be arranged inside? One of the constants across all pieces of home organization advice we've seen so far is the idea of grouping like with like. And perhaps no one so directly flies in the face of that advice as Yukio Noguchi. "I have to emphasize," says Noguchi, "that a very fundamental principle in my method is not to group files according to content." Noguchi is an economist at the University of Tokyo and the author of a series of books that offer super tricks for sorting out your office and your life. Their titles translate roughly to super persuasion method, super work method, super study method, and most relevantly for us, super organized method. Early in his career as an economist, Noguchi found himself constantly inundated with information, correspondence, data, manuscripts, and losing a significant portion of each day just trying to organize it all. So he looked for an alternative. He began by simply putting each document into a file labeled with the document's title and date, and putting all the files into one big box. That saved time. He didn't have to think about the right place to put each document. But it didn't result in any form of organization. Then, sometime in the early 1990s, he had a breakthrough. He started to insert the files exclusively at the left-hand side of the box. And thus, the super filing system was born. The left-side insertion rule, Noguchi specifies, has to be followed for old files as well as new ones. Every time you pull out a file to use its contents, you must put it back as the leftmost file when you return it to the box. And when you search for a file, you always start from the left-hand side as well. The most recently accessed files are thus the fastest to find. This practice began, Noguchi explains, because returning every file to the left side was just easier than trying to reinsert it at the same spot it came from. Only gradually did he realize that this procedure was not only simple, but also startlingly efficient. The Noguchi filing system clearly saves time when you're replacing something after you're done using it. There's still the question, however, of whether it's a good way to find the files you need in the first place. After all, it certainly goes against the recommendations of other efficiency gurus, who tell us that we should put similar things together. Indeed, even the etymology of the word organized evokes a body composed of organs, which are nothing if not cells grouped like with like, marshaled together by similar form and function. But computer science gives us something that most efficiency gurus don't. Guarantees. Though Noguchi didn't know it at the time, his filing system represents an extension of the LRU principle. LRU tells us that when we add something to our cache, we should discard the oldest item. But it doesn't tell us where we should put the new item. The answer to that question comes from a line of research carried out by computer scientists in the 1970s and 80s. Their version of the problem is called self-organizing lists, and its setup almost exactly mimics Noguchi's filing dilemma. Imagine that you have a set of items in a sequence, and you must periodically search through them to find specific items. The search itself is constrained to be linear. You must look through the items one by one, starting at the beginning. But once you find the item you're looking for, you can put it back anywhere in the sequence. Where should you replace the items to make searching as efficient as possible? The definitive paper on self-organizing lists, published by Daniel Slater and Robert Tarjan in 1985, examined, in classic computer science fashion, the worst-case performance of various ways to organize the list, given all possible sequences of requests. Intuitively, since the search starts at the front, you want to arrange the sequence so that the items most likely to be searched for appear there. But which items will those be? We're back to wishing for clairvoyance again. If you know the sequence ahead of time, says Tarjan, who splits his time between Princeton and Silicon Valley, You can customize the data structure to minimize the total time for the entire sequence. That's the optimum offline algorithm, God's algorithm, if you will, or the algorithm in the sky. Of course, nobody knows the future, so the question is, if you don't know the future, how close can you come to this optimum algorithm in the sky? Slater and Tarjan's results showed that some very simple self-adjusting schemes, amazingly, come within a constant factor of clairvoyance. Namely, if you follow the LRU principle, where you simply always put an item back at the very front of the list, then the total amount of time you spend searching will never be more than twice as long as if you'd known the future. That's not a guarantee any other algorithm can make. Recognizing the Noguchi filing system as an instance of the LRU principle in action tells us that it is not merely efficient, it's actually optimal. Slater and Tarjan's results also provide us with one further twist, and we get it by turning the Noguchi filing system on its side. Quite simply, a box of files on its side becomes a pile. And it's the very nature of piles that you search them from top to bottom, and that each time you pull out a document, it goes back not where you found it, but on top. In short, the mathematics of self-organizing lists suggests something radical. The big pile of papers on your desk, far from being a guilt-inducing fester of chaos, is actually one of the most well-designed and efficient structures available. What might appear to others to be an unorganized mess is, in fact, a self-organizing mess. Tossing things back on the top of the pile is the very best you can do, shy of knowing the future. In the previous chapter, we examined cases where leaving something unsorted was more efficient than taking the time to sort everything. Here, however, there's a very different reason why you don't need to organize it. You already have. The forgetting curve. Of course, no discussion of memory could be complete without mention of the memory organ closest to home, the human brain. Over the past few decades, the influence of computer science has brought about something of a revolution in how psychologists think about memory. The science of human memory is said to have begun in 1879 with a young psychologist at the University of Berlin named Hermann Ebbinghaus. Ebbinghaus wanted to get to the bottom of how human memory worked, and to show that it was possible to study the mind with all the mathematical rigor of the physical sciences. So he began to experiment on himself. Each day, Ebbinghaus would sit down and memorize a list of nonsense syllables. Then he would test himself on lists from previous days. Pursuing this habit over the course of a year, he established many of the most basic results in human memory research. He confirmed, for instance, that practicing a list multiple times makes it persist longer in memory, and that the number of items one can accurately recall goes down as time passes. His results mapped out a graph of how memory fades over time, known today by psychologists as the forgetting curve. Ebbinghaus's results established the credibility of a quantitative science of human memory, but they left open something of a mystery. Why this particular curve? Does it suggest that human memory is good or bad? What's the underlying story here? These questions have stimulated psychologists' speculation and research for more than 100 years. In 1987, Carnegie Mellon psychologist and computer scientist John Anderson found himself reading about the information retrieval systems of university libraries. Anderson's goal, or so he thought, was to write about how the design of those systems could be informed by the study of human memory. Instead, the opposite happened. He realized that information science could provide the missing piece in the study of the mind. For a long time, says Anderson, I had felt that there was something missing in the existing theories of human memory, including my own. Basically, All of these theories characterized memory as an arbitrary and non-optimal configuration. I had long felt that the basic memory processes were quite adaptive and perhaps even optimal. However, I had never been able to see a framework in which to make this point. In the computer science work on information retrieval, I saw that framework laid out before me. A natural way to think about forgetting is that our minds simply run out of space. The key idea behind Anderson's new account of human memory is that the problem might not be one of storage, but of organization. According to his theory, the mind has essentially infinite capacity for memories, but we have only a finite amount of time in which to search for them. Anderson made the analogy to a library with a single, arbitrarily long shelf, the Noguchi filing system at Library of Congress scale. You can fit as many items as you want on that shelf, but the closer something is to the front, the faster it will be to find. The key to a good human memory then becomes the same as the key to a good computer cache, predicting which items are most likely to be wanted in the future. Barring clairvoyance, the best approach to making such predictions in the human world requires understanding the world itself. With his collaborator Lael Schooler, Anderson set out to perform Ebbinghaus-like studies not on human minds, but on human society. The question was straightforward. What patterns characterize the way the world itself forgets? The way that events and references fade over time? Anderson and Schooler analyzed three human environments: headlines from the New York Times, recordings of parents talking to their children, and Anderson's own email inbox. In all domains, they found that a word is most likely to appear again right after it has just been used, and that the likelihood of seeing it again falls off as time goes on. In other words, reality itself has a statistical structure that mimics the Ebbinghaus curve. This suggests something remarkable. If the pattern by which things fade from our minds is the very pattern by which things fade from use around us, then there may be a very good explanation indeed for the Ebbinghaus forgetting curve, namely, that it's a perfect tuning of the brain to the world, making available precisely the things most likely to be needed. In putting the emphasis on time, caching shows us that memory involves unavoidable trade-offs and a certain zero-sumness. You can't have every library book at your desk, every product on display at the front of the store, every headline above the fold, every paper at the top of the pile. And in the same way, you can't have every fact or face or name at the front of your mind. Many people hold the bias that human memory is anything but optimal, wrote Anderson and Schooler. They point to the many frustrating failures of memory. However, these criticisms fail to appreciate the task before human memory, which is to try to manage a huge stockpile of memories. In any system responsible for managing a vast database, there must be failures of retrieval. It is just too expensive to maintain access to an unbounded number of items. This understanding has, in turn, led to a second revelation about human memory. If these trade-offs really are unavoidable, and the brain appears to be optimally tuned to the world around it, then what we refer to as the inevitable cognitive decline that comes with age may in fact be something else. The tyranny of experience. A big book is a big nuisance. Callimachus, 305 to 410 BC, librarian at Alexandria. Why don't they make the whole plane out of that black box stuff? Stephen Wright. The need for a computer memory hierarchy, in the form of a cascade of caches, is in large part the result of our inability to afford making the entire memory out of the most expensive type of hardware. The fastest cache on current computers, for instance, is made with what's called SRAM, which costs roughly 1,000 times as much per byte as the flash memory in solid-state drives. But the true motivation for caching goes deeper than that. In fact, even if we could get a bespoke machine that used exclusively the fastest form of memory possible, we'd still need caches. As John Hennessy explains, size alone is enough to impair speed. When you make something bigger, it's inherently slower, right? If you make a city bigger, it takes longer to get from point A to point B. If you make a library bigger, it takes longer to find a book in the library. If you have a stack of papers on your desk that's bigger, it takes longer to find the paper you're looking for, right? Caches are actually a solution to that problem. For example, right now, if you go to buy a processor, what you'll get is a level 1 cache and a level 2 cache on the chip. The reason that there are, even just on the chip there are two caches, is that in order to keep up with the cycle rate of the processor, the first level cache is limited in size. Unavoidably, the larger a memory is, the more time it takes to search for and extract a piece of information from it. Tom and I, in our 30s, already find ourselves more frequently stalling a conversation as, for instance, we wait for the name of someone on the tip of our tongues to come to mind. Then again, at age 10, I had 24 schoolmates. 20 years later, I have hundreds of contacts in my phone and thousands on Facebook, and have lived in 4 cities, each with its own community of friends, acquaintances, and colleagues. Tom, by this point in his academic career, has worked with hundreds of collaborators and taught thousands of students. In fact, this very book involved meeting with about 100 people and citing 1,000. Such effects are by no means limited to social connections, of course. A typical 2-year-old knows 200 words. A typical adult knows 30,000. And when it comes to episodic memory, well, every year adds 250,000 waking minutes to one's total lived experience. Considered this way, it's a wonder that the two of us, or anyone, can mentally keep up at all. What's surprising is not memory's slowdown, but the fact that the mind can possibly stay afloat and responsive as so much data accumulates. If the fundamental challenge of memory really is one of organization rather than storage, perhaps it should change how we think about the impact of aging on our mental abilities. Recent work by a team of psychologists and linguists led by Michael Ramskar at the University of Tübingen has suggested that what we call cognitive decline, lags and retrieval errors, may not be about the search process slowing or deteriorating, but at least partly an unavoidable consequence of the amount of information we have to navigate getting bigger and bigger. Regardless of whatever other challenges aging brings, older brains, which must manage a greater store of memories, are literally solving harder computational problems with every passing day. The old can mock the young for their speed. It's because you don't know anything yet. Ramskar's group demonstrated the impact of extra information on human memory by focusing on the case of language. Through a series of simulations, the researchers showed that simply knowing more makes things harder when it comes to recognizing words, names, and even letters. No matter how good your organization scheme is, having to search through more things will inevitably take longer. It's not that we're forgetting. It's that we're remembering. We're becoming archives. An understanding of the unavoidable computational demands of memory, Ramskar says, should help people come to terms with the effects of aging on cognition. I think the most important tangible thing seniors can do is to try to get a handle on the idea that their minds are natural information processing devices, he writes. Some things that might seem frustrating as we grow older, like remembering names, are a function of the amount of stuff we have to sift through, and are not necessarily a sign of a failing mind. As he puts it, a lot of what is currently called decline is simply learning. Caching gives us the language to understand what's happening. We say brain fart when we should really say cache miss. The disproportionate occasional lags in information retrieval are a reminder of just how much we benefit the rest of the time by having what we need at the front of our minds. So as you age and begin to experience these sporadic latencies, take heart. The length of a delay is partly an indicator of the extent of your experience. The effort of retrieval is a testament to how much you know. And the rarity of those lags is a testament to how well you've arranged it, keeping the most important things closest to hand. 5. Scheduling. First things first. How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. Annie Dillard. Why don't we write a book on scheduling theory? I asked. It shouldn't take much time. Book writing, like war making, often entails grave miscalculations. 15 years later, scheduling is still unfinished. Eugene Lawler. It's Monday morning, and you have an as-yet blank schedule and a long list of tasks to complete. Some can only be started after others are finished. You can't load the dishwasher unless it's unloaded first. And some can be started only after a certain time. The neighbors will complain if you put the trash out on the curb before Tuesday night. Some have sharp deadlines, others can be done whenever, and many are fuzzily in between. Some are urgent, but not important. Some are important, but not urgent. We are what we repeatedly do, you seem to recall Aristotle saying. Whether it's mop the floor, spend more time with your kids, file your taxes on time, learn French. So what to do, and when, and in what order? Your life is waiting. But we always manage to find some way to order the things we do in our days. As a rule, we don't consider ourselves particularly good at it. Hence the perennial bestseller status of time management guides. Unfortunately, the guidance we find in them is frequently divergent and inconsistent. Getting things done advocates a policy of immediately doing any task of 2 minutes or less as soon as it comes to mind. Rival bestseller Eat That Frog advises beginning with the most difficult task and moving toward easier and easier things. The Now Habit suggests first scheduling one's social engagements and leisure time, and then filling the gaps with work, rather than the other way around, as we so often do. William James, the father of American psychology, asserts that there's nothing so fatiguing as the eternal hanging on of an uncompleted task. But Frank Partnoy, in Wait, makes the case for deliberately not doing things right away. Every guru has a different system, and it's hard to know who to listen to. Spending time becomes a science. Though time management seems a problem as old as time itself, the science of scheduling began in the machine shops of the Industrial Revolution. In 1874, Frederick Taylor, the son of a wealthy lawyer, turned down his acceptance at Harvard to become an apprentice machinist at Enterprise Hydraulic Works in Philadelphia. 4 years later, he completed his apprenticeship and began working at the Midvale Steelworks, where he rose through the ranks from lathe operator to machine shop foreman and ultimately to chief engineer. In the process, he came to believe that the time of the machines and people he oversaw was not being used very well, leading him to develop a discipline he called scientific management. Taylor created a planning office, at the heart of which was a bulletin board displaying the shop's schedule for all to see. The board depicted every machine in the shop, showing the task currently being carried out by that machine and all the tasks waiting for it. This practice would be built upon by Taylor's colleague Henry Gantt, who in the 1910s developed the Gantt charts that would help organize many of the 20th century's most ambitious construction projects, from the Hoover Dam to the Interstate Highway System. A century later, Gantt charts still adorn the walls and screens of project managers at firms like Amazon, IKEA, and SpaceX. Taylor and Gantt made scheduling an object of study, and they gave it visual and conceptual form. But they didn't solve the fundamental problem of determining which schedules were best. The first hint that this problem even could be solved wouldn't appear until several decades later, in a 1954 paper published by RAND Corporation mathematician Selmer Johnson. The scenario Johnson examined was bookbinding, where each book needs to be printed on one machine and then bound on another. But the most common instance of this two-machine setup is much closer to home, the laundry. When you wash your clothes, they have to pass through the washer and the dryer in sequence, and different loads will take different amounts of time in each. A heavily soiled load might take longer to wash, but the usual time to dry. A large load might take longer to dry, but the usual time to wash. So, Johnson asked, if you have several loads of laundry to do on the same day, what's the best way to do them? His answer was that you should begin by finding the single step that takes the least amount of time, the load that will wash or dry the quickest. If that shortest step involves the washer, plan to do that load first. If it involves the dryer, plan to do it last. Repeat this process for the remaining loads, working from the two ends of the schedule toward the middle. Intuitively, Johnson's algorithm works because, regardless of how you sequence the loads, there's going to be some time at the start when the washer is running but not the dryer, and some time at the end when the dryer is running but not the washer. By having the shortest washing times at the start and the shortest drying times at the end, you maximize the amount of overlap when the washer and dryer are running simultaneously. Thus, you can keep the total amount of time spent doing laundry to the absolute minimum. Johnson's analysis had yielded scheduling's first optimal algorithm. Start with the lightest wash, end with the smallest hamper. Beyond its immediate applications, Johnson's paper revealed two deeper points. First, that scheduling could be expressed algorithmically. And second, that optimal scheduling solutions existed. This kicked off what has become a sprawling literature, exploring strategies for a vast menagerie of hypothetical factories with every conceivable number and kind of machines. We're going to focus on a tiny subset of this literature, the part that, unlike bookbinding or laundry, deals with scheduling for a single machine. Because the scheduling problem that matters the most involves just one machine, ourselves. Handling deadlines. With single machine scheduling, we run into something of a problem right off the bat. Johnson's work on bookbinding was based on minimizing the total time required for the two machines to complete all of their jobs. In the case of single machine scheduling, however, if we are going to do all the tasks assigned, then all schedules will take equally long to complete. The order is irrelevant. This is a sufficiently fundamental and counterintuitive point that it's worth repeating. If you have only a single machine, and you're going to do all of your tasks, then any ordering of the tasks will take you the same amount of time. Thus, we encounter the first lesson in single machine scheduling literally before we even begin. Make your goals explicit. We can't declare some schedule a winner until we know how we're keeping score. This is something of a theme in computer science. Before you can have a plan, you must first choose a metric. And as it turns out, which metric we pick here will directly affect which scheduling approaches fare best. The first papers on single machine scheduling followed quickly on the heels of Johnson's bookbinding work and offered several plausible metrics to consider. For each metric, they discovered a simple, optimal strategy. It is, of course, common, for instance, for tasks to have a due date, with the lateness of a task being how far it has gone overdue. So we can think of the maximum lateness of a set of tasks as the lateness of whatever task has gone furthest past its due date, the kind of thing your employer might care about in a performance review, or what your customers might care about in a retail or service setting, where the maximally late task corresponds to the customer subject to the longest wait time. If you're concerned with minimizing maximum lateness, then the best strategy is to start with the task due soonest and work your way toward the task due last. This strategy, known as earliest due date, is fairly intuitive. For instance, in a service sector context where each arriving patron's due date is effectively the instant they walk in the door, it just means serving customers in order of arrival. But some of its implications are surprising. For example, how long each task will take to complete is entirely irrelevant. It doesn't change the plan, so in fact, you don't even need to know. All that matters is when the tasks are due. You might already be using earliest due date to tackle your workload, in which case you probably don't need computer science to tell you that it's a sensible strategy. What you may not have known, though, is that it's the optimal strategy. More precisely, it is optimal assuming that you're only interested in one metric in particular, reducing your maximum lateness. If that's not your goal, however, then another strategy might be more applicable. For instance, consider the refrigerator. If you're one of the many people who have a community-supported agriculture, CSA, subscription, then every week or two you've got a lot of fresh produce coming to your doorstep all at once. Each piece of produce is set to spoil on a different date. So eating them by earliest due date in order of their spoilage schedule seems like a reasonable starting point. It's not, however, the end of the story. Earliest due date is optimal for reducing maximum lateness, which means it will minimize the rottenness of the single most rotten thing you'll have to eat. And that may not be the most appetizing metric to eat by. Maybe instead we want to minimize the number of foods that spoil. Here a strategy called Moore's algorithm gives us our best plan. Moore's algorithm says that we start out just like with earliest due date, by scheduling our produce in order of spoilage date, earliest first, one item at a time. However, as soon as it looks like we won't get to eating the next item in time, we pause, look back over the meals we've already planned, and throw out the biggest item, that is, the one that would take the most days to consume. For instance, that might mean foregoing the watermelon that would take a half dozen servings to eat. Not even attempting it will mean getting to everything that follows a lot sooner. We then repeat this pattern, laying out the foods by spoilage date and tossing the largest already scheduled item any time we fall behind. Once everything that remains can be eaten in order of spoilage date without anything spoiling, we've got our plan. Moore's algorithm minimizes the number of items you'll need to throw away. Of course, you're also welcome to compost the food, donate it to the local food bank, or give it to your neighbor. In an industrial or bureaucratic context where you can't simply discard a project, but in which the number, rather than the severity of late projects, is still your biggest concern, Moore's algorithm is just as indifferent about how those late tasks are handled. Anything booted from the main portion of your schedule can get done at the very end, in any order. It doesn't matter, as they're all already late. Getting things done. Do the difficult things while they are easy, and do the great things while they are small. Lao Tzu. Sometimes due dates aren't our primary concern, and we just want to get stuff done. As much stuff as quickly as possible. It turns out that translating this seemingly simple desire into an explicit scheduling metric is harder than it sounds. One approach is to take an outsider's perspective. We've noted that in single machine scheduling, nothing we do can change how long it will take us to finish all of our tasks. But if each task, for instance, represents a waiting client, then there is a way to take up as little of their collective time as possible. Imagine starting on Monday morning with a 4-day project and a 1-day project on your agenda. If you deliver the bigger project on Thursday afternoon, 4 days elapsed, and then the smaller one on Friday afternoon,